Ulwit said. He petted Muffin briskly to calm him and expertly gripped his jaws from beneath and pried them open. See? Your turn, Marianne. So Marianne, shaky-fingered, tried and tried and at last succeeded, and Muffin swallowed his capsule. Animals are basically wildlife, Witt said with an air of approval. Domestic cats, dogs, just the surface 10% is domesticated. The rest is nature. Right, Muff? He rubbed the cat's ears and Muffin blinked up at him. Marianne thought, they understand each other. But what is it they understand? And when, finally, Muffin did die a few months later, very thin, his eyes tawny yellow with jaundice, it was in Marianne's arms as Witt injected him with a medicine that stopped his heart instantaneously. He had weakened at the end swiftly in a matter of days. He'd simply stopped eating. He had not crept away to die in the woods, as Marianne feared, had never ventured outdoors much at this new place, shy of the numerous feral cats who lived on the grounds, but dozed for long hours atop Marianne's bed on her ragged old quilt. At night, he'd slept pressed against Marianne's leg, breathing thinly, twitching from time to time in such a way that Marianne, lying awake, wondered if he would live until morning. Marianne told Witt now, "We're ready. We're prepared for it." Witt said gently, "Muffin is, Marianne. But are you?" She did not answer. Yet as Witt sank the thin needle into Muffin's bony shoulder and the cat cringed and went rigid, and immediately then limp, lifeless as a rag doll, Marianne held him firmly and did not break down. "Oh my God, can this be? Can this really be happening?" She stared in astonishment at the now dead cat in her arms, his eyes open, blank. Yet she did not break down, at least at this time. Witt was sitting on the edge of Marianne's brass bed, stroking Muffin's fur that was so soft and fine. Marianne could not bear to look at him, yet saw glistening on his cheeks. Witt said, "Muffin wasn't your only friend, Marianne." Marianne said calmly, "Well, I know that." Witt said, "He wasn't the only one who loves you, Marianne." "Well," said Marianne, now just slightly hesitating, as if at the edge of an abyss, yet calmly enough, "I know that too." Was that Judd? That tall, lean-limbed, staring young man, waiting in the hospital corridor for Marianne to hug her and lead her into the intensive care unit? And was that Corinne? Hair gone unevenly gray, a powdery, pebbly gray, a hectic flush in her thin cheeks. Rushing at Marianne, embracing her so hard, Marianne felt the breath squeezed from her. "Oh, Marianne, thank God you're here, honey. Dad's just waking up." The air in this place was chilled as a refrigerator. There was a humming on all sides. Marianne couldn't stop shivering. She and her mother were staring at each other with widened, amazed eyes. Corinne whispered, "Don't be surprised, Marianne. Dad has had surgery to remove a cancerous lung. He's been delirious off and on since yesterday. He isn't the way you remember him." Marianne was dazed with exhaustion. She'd driven from Stump Creek Hill to the medical clinic, University of Rochester, 300 miles, nearly non-stop, more than 6 hours in the rattling Chevy pickup, and much of the route along narrow country highways, and in Rochester, she hadn't known where the medical center was, so she'd had to stop to ask directions several times, intimidated by so much traffic, intimidated by the size and complexity of the city in which she had never been before, and by the nightmare network of elevated expressways, on and off ramps, exit-only lanes, praying aloud in a child's scared voice, "Dear God, dear Jesus, don't let my father die." And now, as in a dream others had somehow entered and even appropriated, she was being led forward by her mother, Mom she loved so, Mom she'd missed so. Mom, gripping both Marianne's hands in hers, such cold, anxious fingers. And Marianne found herself inside not a room but a cubicle, staring at a person in a raised bed amid glittering, beeping instruments. Why, he was no one Marianne knew, was he? An ashy-skinned, sunken-eyed, sunken-cheeked man of some age beyond age. His hair was thin, tin-colored strips across the waxy, vein-splattered dome of his scalp. There were clawed-looking creases in his cheeks, His eyes peered out wildly from deep, bruised sockets. A transparent tube ran into his left nostril, and tubes were attached to his shrunken arms and disappeared beneath the bedclothes covering his flat, yet bulky, body. Marianne stared in disbelief, even as Corinne murmured eagerly, "Michael? Darling? See who's here. She's come such a long way. It's Marianne." The man who was Michael Mulvaney Sr., the man who was Dad, Dad so changed, squinted at Marianne as if a light blinded him. He tried to move his head on the raised pillow, but the tube that ran into his nostril seemed to hold him in place. His right eye was badly bloodshot and not in focus. The air hummed with cold, with ventilators, with machines. A computer screen registered nervous, zigzaggy blue lines. Corinne urged Marianne forward. Marianne dared to take her father's hand that groped along the bed rail. Such a thin, cold hand, the bones seemingly hollow, yet the fingers closed about hers with unexpected strength, urgency. Michael tried to speak, tried very hard, but the sound came out garbled, a sound like drowning, terrible to hear. Marianne said, leaning over the bed, anxiously yet smiling, "Daddy, it's me." He tugged at her hand as if by sheer strength he hoped to lift himself from the bed and break free of his restraints that seemed to confound him. At last he managed to mutter coherent words, phrases.
"Where? Didn't want to. So tired. I want. God help. Where is. So tired. So tired."
And abruptly then his strength waned. He sank back and shut his eyes, his breath hoarse. His grip on Marianne's hand loosened. She continued to hold it tight.
"Daddy? Oh, Daddy, I'm so sorry," she said.
Resolute she would not cry, and for what seemed a long time, the three of them waited for Michael to open his eyes again as he lay there in his bed, drifting in sleep yet not peaceably, mouth working, eyeballs moving jerkily behind shut lids. He twitched, moaned, seemed to be arguing with someone. He was like one who has sunk beneath the surface of consciousness, as beneath the surface of water, floating there, gathering his desperate strength to reemerge, to save himself. How close the surface was, yet how tough the membrane that trapped him beneath it. A nurse entered the cubicle and told them to wait outside, and so they did. And again Corinne gripped Marianne's hands, staring at her almost greedily. It had not been clear to Marianne initially that her mother was so exhausted, even as she spoke in a strangely exhilarated voice. "Marianne, my goodness, you're so grown up, isn't she, Judd? And your hair, oh dear, your hair. Oh, but how pretty you are, Marianne. I know you're exhausted. I know this is a terrible surprise. Your dad does want to speak to you. He told us, didn't he, Judd? Oh, what a sad, terrible time for us. We can pray, that's all we can do, but it's a sad time. We have to be prepared, the nurses have warned us. Dad was staying at this terrible, filthy hotel downtown. He'd collapsed on the street and had been here in the hospital for more than a week before anyone took the trouble to look through his things and call me, his own wife, his nearest of kin. Imagine!" Turning to Judd, who shrugged as if embarrassed, and who said to Marianne, "Dad's indigent. He's an alcoholic, a charity case. Frankly, I think we're lucky he's had this much care at all." And Corinne said quickly,
"Oh, yes, thank God, you're right. Judd is right, of course. Thank God his things weren't just dumped out on the street and my name and address lost. I'm grateful someone from the hospital did call. I'm grateful the doctors took him in and operated, though there doesn't seem now anybody for me to talk to exactly. The surgeon is never available. I never spoke with the surgeon at all. But the nurses are nice, so understanding and kind. And Dad isn't really insured any longer. I'm under a medical coverage with the county where I work, but not Dad. Oh, Marianne, they removed a lung, but they said it's too late. The cancer has spread to his brain, his kidneys, meticized."
And Judd said gently, "Metastasized, Mom."
"Metastasized, of course."
Corinne had begun to cry silently, in that way that Marianne recalled for the first time in years. A mother's crying, stifled, soundless, secret so as not to disturb. If you cried so others could hear, you were crying to be heard, but a mother's crying was just the opposite, crying not to be heard. Yet now, Corinne could not hide from her adult children. Judd said matter-of-factly to Marianne, in that way that was wits too much of the time, as if the worst, the bluntest truth might as well be acknowledged. He's just worn down, worn out. His liver has been affected, his heart, all the years of heavy drinking. Smoking caused the cancer, but it's obvious he'd been killing himself for years. Poor Dad. Corinne said vehemently, tugging at Marianne's arm, Oh, he was a good man, and he loved you. He loved you all. It was just he was led astray. He's only 61 years old, Marianne. Imagine, that's not old at all. Marianne heard herself say, scarcely knowing what the words meant, No, Mom, that's not old at all. Later that day, they returned to Michael Mulvaney's bedside in the chilled, humming cubicle amid the bustle of intensive care, and another time Michael fought his way to the surface of consciousness, fixing his good, focused eye upon Marianne, struggling to speak. Marianne said, Daddy, I love you. Don't tire yourself, Daddy, just rest. Daddy, I'm so sorry. But Michael was squeezing her hand, trying with such urgency to speak, out of a garble of noises, syllables of words emerged like pebbles in a rushing stream. And Marianne believed she heard her name, Marianne. And her father was looking at her, staring at her. He had recognized her, Marianne, hadn't he? There came a final, feeble spasm of strength, his fingers clasping hers. Then again, the dying man lost the thread of consciousness and sank back on the pillow. In one of the patches of waiting that were like pleats in time, while Corinne remained at their father's bedside in case he should wake, Marianne and Judd, faint with hunger, had a quick meal in the hospital cafeteria. And afterward, grateful for each other's company, like old friends who'd somehow forgotten how much they liked each other, went outside to walk for a half hour in the bright, windy autumn air. How strangely vivid, how vast the world was. The sky so steeply overhead, just there. In a fluorescent, chill-humming room, you could easily forget how the world, the sky, were there. Marianne said wonderingly, Daddy did recognize me, I think. He did, Judd, didn't he? I'm not just imagining it. And Judd said, Yeah, of course he did. Marianne laughed, embarrassed, biting at a thumbnail. Judd said, frowning, He called you Marianne, that's what I heard. Marianne said, I guess he's forgiven me. I mean, he loves me again, he's not ashamed of me. And Judd said, Dad always loved you, Marianne. He wasn't ashamed, exactly, it was, well, like Mom said, it was just something that happened. Marianne repeated slowly, Just something that happened. Judd said, It's the way families are sometimes. A thing goes wrong and no one knows how to fix it, and years pass and no one knows how to fix it. He spoke quickly, almost combatively. Marianne said, Dad saw me, I'm sure he did. Judd said, Marianne, for God's sake, he said your name. Mom heard him and so did I. When Marianne didn't reply, walking now swiftly with her head lowered, plucking at her long, untidy ponytail, blowing in the wind, he added, with brotherly indulgence and impatience, as if this was an old family issue once again resurfacing when it ought to have been settled long ago. He'd been asking for you. That's why Mom called you. He asked for Marianne. I heard him, I swear. And he didn't ask for any of the rest of us, his sons, by name. Mom and I kind of worked out what he was trying to say. He wants to see Mike and Patrick, too, but couldn't remember their names exactly, or couldn't pronounce them. We're pretty sure. But your name, Marianne, he knew. Don't you believe me? So Marianne decided, yes, she would believe him. Cremate my body and scatter my ashes, and that's the kindest thing you can do for me. Amen. That gusty October morning, the sky pebbly pale with streaks of vivid blue like swaths of a house painter's brush. Wind. Wind, a high keening sound, rocking the car as we ascended. On the rear seat of Mike's car, between Marianne and me, the box containing the remains of Michael Mulvaney Sr., of about the size and proportions of a hat box. I'd peeked. I had to know. These were sizable bone fragments, grit like chunks of gravel as well as powdery fine ashes. It was the morning following the funeral in Rochester. We were silent mourners. There was little to say that had not been said. I did not say bitterly, "Where the hell is Patrick? I hate that bastard." We passed High Point Farm on our left, but I was looking resolutely away and did not see. Or my eyes may have been shut tight. Abruptly, then, High Point Road narrowed and became more rutted, jolting. In winter, snowplows wouldn't bother much with this stretch. Dust rose in angry swirls in our wake. By instinct, Mike was taking us to the perfect place. I knew exactly where he'd park. No houses for miles, no one to drive by gawking curiously at us. "Mulvaney's? Back? What on earth are you doing here?" A high, windy glacier ridge overlooking a near-vertical drop of hundreds of feet, scarred-looking boulders strewn below, vivid patches of scarlet sumac. It was fall, a cold-tasting fall, the leaves having quickly turned bright, brilliant shades of orange, yellow, russet red, to be quickly torn from the trees. Dad's voice came teasing in my ears. "Be sure to keep the wind at your back, kid. Don't err at such a crucial time. You're not going to get a second chance." Scattering the earthly remains of Michael John Mulvaney Sr. to the wind. And how swiftly the wind tore at them, a savage appetite. Hyena keening, roaring up out of the valley. Mom said suddenly, "I can hear Dad laughing, can't you? Oh, this is funny, somehow. He'd think so." Mike and I lifted the clumsy box, shaking out the last of the grit and ashes, as the wind took them so roughly and gone. Epilogue. Reunion, July 4th, 1993. The phone rang. I picked it up and it was Mom, breathless and hopeful as a girl. "Come for a 4th of July cookout, Judd. Come for a Mulvaney family reunion. Come help Sable and me celebrate Alder Antiques and Independence." It was mid-June, weeks ahead of time. Remarkable for my mom, who usually telephoned to invite me over at the last minute. I said, "Yes, of course I'd come. Sounds like a great idea," I said. "But what's this about a Mulvaney family reunion?" Mom insisted it was so. "All of you are coming, including Patrick." This I let pass in silence. I asked what would she and Sable like me to bring, and Mom said, "Just yourself, honey. And you know, if you had a girl, but I don't. Well, you know. Maybe I'll acquire a girl between now and then," I said, teasing. "How's that? Bring yourself and whoever you like. This will be our first annual Mulvaney family reunion." I must have sighed. Did I believe for a fraction of a second that Patrick would show up? After 14 years? Marianne and Witt, sure. Mike and Vicky, yeah, probably. But Patrick? Never. Mom said reproachfully, as if I'd spoken aloud, "Judd, this time he's promised. We were just now talking on the phone." Mom and Patrick were in touch sporadically. The last news I had of Patrick firsthand, he was living in Berkeley, California, and training to be a therapist of some kind. Or was he training others to be therapists? So far as I knew, he'd never finished his degree at Cornell. He'd been out of contact with us at the time of Dad's death, which was why he hadn't come to the funeral and helped us scatter Dad's ashes. Though possibly he wouldn't have come anyway. All these years, he hadn't come east to see us, and if Mom suggested flying out to see him, he'd seem to vaporize, disappear. I had a picture of swirling molecules where a human figure had been, so dissolved into its element there could be no identity. Still, Mom had gotten it into her head that Patrick would be coming for the reunion on July 4th. Yes, he'd promised, and he was even planning to bring a friend, a woman friend, Mom believed, though she was vague about this, as no doubt Patrick had been purposely vague in telling her. He'd be traveling all that distance by motorcycle, backpacking en route. Can you imagine, Judd? PJ on a motorcycle? Mom was incredulous and hopeful as a girl. I said, "Frankly, Mom, no, I can't imagine." In Chautauqua Falls, where I now live and work as editor of the Chautauqua Falls Journal, I went shopping on the morning of July 4th, buying a bushel of sweet corn at a farm stand, selecting the ears individually, carefully. I went to our local beer and wine store and bought 6 packs of beer, ale, soda pop. Then to a food store, filling the cart with giant bags of potato chips and pretzels, costly little containers of dip, feeling generous, elated, giddy, and anxious. And the girl at the checkout counter, who knew me, laughed and said, "Looks like you're going to a 4th of July cookout." And I said, proudly, "That's almost right, yes. It's a family reunion, too." My fingers so mysteriously numb, one of the tins slipped and tumbled to the floor. Mom's new home, which she shared with her friend Sable Mills, was on a hillside on New Canaan Road, about 6 miles south of Mount Ephraim and 18 miles southwest of High Point Farm. I'd seen my mom's place a number of times, of course, since Chautauqua Falls was only 40 miles away, and in fact I'd helped her move in. I'd helped her and Sable fix up the property and given my advice about whom to hire for renovations. I have to admit, the place is attractive. The house and outbuildings and pastures, what you can see from the narrow country road. That pert little barn, freshly painted an eye-catching royal blue with the sign Alder Antiques, prominently displayed. Sable and I fell in love with the property and just had to have it, Mom said. And Sable added emphatically, "Love at first sight!" Corinne Mulvaney's specialty at Alder Antiques was refinishing furniture, recovering cushions, etc. Sable's specialty was repairing rattan, wicker, etc. Corinne's inclination was for hominess, housekeeping. Sable's for keeping accounts, business. The one was all breathy sweetness on the phone, the other staccato as a machine gun, thrilling in her own decisiveness. Sable was a good-looking, trim woman of 5'1", brassy dyed hair, cruel stylish ear clamps, magenta lipstick, flashy sporty clothes, expensive high-heeled boots. She'd had experience selling antique furniture and clothes off and on over a period of 20 years. She, too, had grown children, in fact several grandchildren, and she, too, was unmarried at the present time. She liked to discomfort my mother by remarking she hadn't any idea if her ex-husbands, yes, plural, 3, were living or dead, nor any great desire to be illuminated on the score. "When I'm finished with a person, I'm finished," Sable boasted, drawing a forefinger across her throat, "whether he is or not." Mom would glance at me tremulously, both of us thinking of Dad. I don't know what Mom told Sable Mills about Dad, about our family. I'm inclined to think she's told Sable very little. For what are the words with which to summarize a lifetime? So much crowded, confused happiness terminated by such stark, slow-motion pain. The vision of the wind off High Point Road bearing bone, grit, ash, away into infinity. So Mom and her friend Sable Mills teamed up to buy the 3-acre Alder Creek property, house and barn and a few ramshackle outbuildings in the summer of 1991, and began Alder Antiques with Sable's savings and a bank loan. If they weren't exaggerating or embellishing, they would have repaid the loan completely by July 4th, 1993. Independence Day, so come help celebrate. I was proud of Mom and hopeful for her. After Dad's death, she'd gone through a bad spell. Not actively unhappy and never complaining, certainly not what you'd call depressed, but for a long time just not herself. It was during this time Mom's hair turned silver, glittering like mica, and seemed even to have lost its kinky wave. She wore it plaited into a thick braid that swung between her shoulder blades. She'd become a striking woman after whom people glanced admiringly on the street as if wondering, "Who's that?" I must have observed the change so gradually, the way I register changes in myself, my own face that isn't a boy's face any longer. I would be 30 years old, July 11th. There was never a moment when I actually saw. Marianne and I discussed Mom on the phone. I remarked how long ago and far away it seemed now, lanky, carroty-haired whistle making such a commotion in the kitchen. The way she'd call us down for breakfast, remember? "Wake up, rise and shine, kiddos." But Marianne, nursing Willie, even as we spoke, said gently, "You know, Judd, maybe Mom doesn't want to be Mom right now. Maybe she's taking time out." Then Sable Mills came into Mom's life like a hurricane, and no looking back. After Dad left her and the property out in Marcina was repossessed, Mom came to live in Mount Ephraim where people knew her and liked her. There came a succession of slow, dull, safe jobs, in the Mount Ephraim Public Library, in a daycare center, at the Chautauqua County Bureau of Records, where eventually she would be promoted to office manager. She lived in an apartment building downtown, and of course she was miserable there. Corinne Mulvaney in a pokey little apartment with no lawn and no animals? She had many women friends, and of course she had church. Yes, she was lonely sometimes when she allowed herself to think of her losses, but of course she was a Christian and an adult, an optimist and a farmer's daughter pragmatist. She knew not to dwell upon what can't be changed. And there was her antiquarian soul. Always going with women friends or alone to auctions in the valley, to rummage sales, flea markets. She bought things sparingly, and always small items, for of course she hadn't much room in her pokey little apartment. But always at the back of her mind she was planning, plotting, how to start a shop of her own again. It happened that she and a brassy-haired woman of some age between 45 and 55, who favored brightly colored cloche hats, snug-fitting jodhpurs, lizard-skin boots, became aware of each other at auctions. Sable Mills was always outbidding Corinne Mulvaney for the same items, and Corinne looked with longing at the younger woman's acquisitions. Sometimes, out of apparent kindness, Sable would allow Corinne to outbid her, calling then across the room, sotto voce, with malicious glee, "Woo! Thank God! Who in her right mind would want such junk?" Others were shocked, but Corinne just laughed. She liked being teased, even mocked. No one ever behaved that way with her any longer. Since her husband had gone away, she was always being treated by her children especially like some fragile, about-to-shatter old thing. So Corinne Mulvaney and Sable Mills came to be friends, going out for coffee or drinks or a meal, after one or another of these exhilarating, exhausting, frustrating auctions, and talking for hours. "My goodness, we have so much in common," Corinne marveled. She and Sable had both lived in the Ransomville area as girls, Sable in town and Corinne in the country. They'd both married young, had children young, and lived alone now. Their children were grown and mainly scattered. They had grandchildren. By this time, Mike and Vicky had two children. Marianne and Whit had had their first baby, whom they adored but saw infrequently. When I arrived at Alder Creek, it wasn't yet 3 p.m., and already cars, pickups, even bicycles were parked everywhere in the drive and on the grassy lawn. So many. What was Mom thinking of, calling this a family reunion? Scram, Mom's and Sable's antic beagle, came rushing at me, barking and sniffing excitedly, tail thumping. The first people I ran into were the Plucketts, hauling enormous watermelons up the drive, all smiles. "Judd, hello! Happy 4th of July!" The next people I ran into were my gorgeous sister-in-law, Vicky, Mrs. Mike Mulvaney Jr., with the caramel-colored hair, very pregnant, again, and her little girl, Chrissy, my firstborn niece, for whom my heart always gave a lurch. Vicky cried, "Judd, aren't you looking handsome?" Standing on tiptoe to give me a breathy little kiss, her basketball belly poking against me, and I lifted Chrissy in my arms with a mock grunt. 4 years old already? What if she'd forgotten her Uncle Judd? She hadn't seen in a year. But she hadn't. And where was Mike? Playing softball, Vicky said, in the goat pasture. And there were damp, smeary kitty kisses from 2-year-old Davy, Mike and Vicky's other child. And there came rushing at me my sister Marianne in Stump Creek Hill yellow t-shirt and shorts, baby Molly Ellen in her arms, and 3-year-old Willie toddling behind, and we hugged and kissed, clutching at each other as always, as if, in the other's absence, each of us had imagined catastrophes. And these phantoms to be laughed eagerly away, dispelled like bad dreams in daylight. And we exchanged a minute's quick news, and I saw that Marianne was in the prime of her young womanhood, the color restored to her skin, a fullness to her face, the stress lines eased, the liquidy yearning in the eyes eased. Now she was 34 years old and married and a mother and a devoted worker at Stump Creek Hill Animal Shelter and Hospital, and her life independent of all Mulvaney's if she should wish it. And what a husband she had! I didn't always get along with bluff, opinionated Whit West, but I admired him immensely. I asked, "Where's Whit? I don't hear him." And Marianne laughed, poked me reprovingly in the chest, and said, "He's on the phone. We haven't been here an hour, have we? Willie?" And already Whit is checking back. He was up late doing emergency surgery on Smoke. Remember Smoke? One of our black bears. An appendectomy. "Oh, but Judd," Marianne said, just remembering. "He's here. He's actually here. And he has a girl." Marianne pointed toward the pasture where a rowdy game of softball was in progress. I didn't need to ask who he was. I said, "So Mom was right." Marianne said, "Isn't Mom always right? I mean, when she's serious." Trembling with excitement, I dumped my bushel basket of sweet corn and groceries onto the nearest picnic table and snatched up a beer from an ice-packed tub and hurried to the pasture behind the blue Alder Antiques barn where Effie and Eddie, the coarse-haired black goats, were watching the game in a shady corner. I took my place beside them, climbing onto the fence. Of the 15 or 16 players, adults and teenagers, I recognized almost no one at first. I felt a pang of hurt, childish disappointment. Why had Mom promised a Mulvaney family reunion when strangers were being invited too? I hoped that no one would cite me and invite me to join the game. The pitcher was a stranger, or so I thought, one of Sable Mill's younger relatives. In dark glasses, sinewy lean, and about my age, but fitter than I was, with hard, tight, compact arm and shoulder muscles, ropey muscled legs gleaming fuzzily bronze, his hair sun-bleached and shaggy to his shoulders. My God, could this be Patrick? My own brother? The thought flashed to me, yet somehow in the excitement of the moment did not adhere. All eyes were on this man, as with almost ritualistic earnestness. In the midst of much joking, laughing, clowning about of the players, he pitched underhand the dazzling white softball to a figure crouched at bat, Sable Mills herself, an energetic and feisty figure, yet not much of an athlete. Sable, with her brassy hair, newly cut in a virtual flat top, a wicked silver clamp on one ear, in black sleeveless sweater and matching jodhpurs that fitted her wiry body as if she'd been poured into them like melted wax. The pitches came courteously, and it almost seemed unnaturally slow, as if the ball were floating through a substance more solid than air, yet managed to drop as it neared the plate in such a cunning way that Sable swung the bat with a grunt and missed, and a second time swung and missed, and the call was, "Two strikes!" The umpire was a neighboring farmer, an oldish man with a father-time wispy beard and an air of quirky authority. And with the third pitch, either Sable or the pitcher had so adjusted to each other that Sable was able to swing the bat and actually strike the ball, sending it scuttling at a sharp angle along the third baseline, an easy catch for a lanky teenaged boy, a second cousin of mine, a houseman from Ransomville, who scooped it up barehanded and pitched it to the first baseman, a stout, white-whiskered fellow whom I recognized as an antique shop proprietor in Mount Ephraim. Clearly not much of an athlete either, as to groans and cheers he fumbled the catch. The ball bounced from his awkward hands and rolled away, even as, with much attendant squealing, clapping, cheers, Sable rushed to first base, there to stand panting and triumphant. I saw Mom in center field, no mistaking that silvery, glittery hair. Mom in sunflower print culottes and sandals, clapping, crying, "Hooray, Sable! Show these kids!" For her age, Corinne Mulvaney was in fact something of an athlete, capable and lithe and smart about conserving her energy. My eye snagged on the second baseman, or woman, a petite dark girl, a stranger I was sure I'd never seen before, in fact like no one I'd ever encountered in the Chautauqua Valley, with olive-pale skin and perfect features, and a Greek sailor cap tilted seductively over her forehead, though she was dressed like any teenager in t-shirt, jeans, sneakers, without socks. Next at bat was a boy of about 12, another of my distant cousins, the horsey-faced houseman look, and he seemed shy, so the pitcher sent several teasing, slow, underhanded balls in such a way as to allow him, too, to connect on what would have been the third strike, a pop fly, unluckily, which the pitcher himself easily snatched from the air. By this time, I'd been drawn into the mood of the game, cheering and clapping at virtually all the plays without discrimination. I just noticed a familiar face among the spectators. Was it Aunt Ethel Hausman? Her hair now steely gray, her figure grimly turnip-shaped in slacks and loose-fitting shirt, but she appeared to be in a genial mood, as if determined to have a good time. There was a murmur of excited expectation as there came trotting to the plate my big brother Mike. Handing his beer can to a bystander as he took up the bat with a flourish and balanced it on the palm of his hand, Mule Mulvaney, soaking up the quick round of applause, and gentlemanly charitable enough, since he was probably the only real athlete on the field, to volunteer to bat southpaw. The lanky pitcher shoved his dark glasses against the bridge of his nose. His face was suntanned, lean. Patrick? Was it possible?
My brother, who'd scorned all team sports, and coolly studied his formidable opponent. People were trailing over from the house to watch. Marianne with her children, Vicky and her children, Chrissy running, crying, "Daddy! Daddy!" Even Effie and Eddie, who'd been imperturbably munching grass, paused to watch. The pitcher wound up like an elastic knot, unleashed himself, and the initial pitch, though underhand, flew across the plate conspicuously faster than the pitches directed at Mike's predecessors. And Mike swung hard and missed, coloring and laughing good-naturedly, leaning over to spit on the ground in mock macho style, returned the bat to his shoulder with a determined look, and again the pitch came, flying fast, deviously dropping just as it crossed the plate, and again Mike swung and missed. Mule Mulvaney, soon to be 40. How was that possible? He'd been discharged several years before from the Marines, with the rank of sergeant, and was now a civil engineer with the state of Delaware, living with his family in Wilmington, husband and father, an upstanding American citizen, it would seem. Something of a stranger to me now, though I'd visited him and his family a few times in their upscale residential neighborhood, and saw him at least once a year in the company of Mom. Another time the pitcher wound up, lanky and sinuous, and the ball came flying.
"Too wide, outside, ball one," declared the umpire.
And the next pitch, too, was declared a ball, and may even have been one. And the next pitch flew unerringly toward the plate, which was in fact a paper picnic plate, and Mike swung the bat with blind, impulsive faith, and there was a crack. As bat and ball connected, and for a fraction of a second, the ball seemed virtually to pause in midair before sailing up, 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 as Mike began to run, and finally down into a grove of trees on the far side of the pasture, where squealing children ran to fetch it. There were manic cheers, applause, as Mike trotted like royalty around the bases, blowing kisses to all, paused to take up Mom's hand and kiss it in the outfield, trotting then to third and home. And my eyes seized with moisture, thinking, how like Dad. For it was as if Michael Mulvaney Sr., at the age of almost 40, had appeared before us, the glimmer of the man at least, the hazy, sunstruck aura out of which Mike Jr.'s features smiled in triumph. So Mike trotted home, carrying Chrissy from third base, and I was whistling and applauding with the others, for so spectacular a home run in Mom's and Sable's goat pasture was something of an occasion, after all. I shaded my eyes, then studying the stranger who was the pitcher, standing abashed now but grinning, a good sport too, as Mike trotted back to home, hands on his lean hips, the lenses of his dark glasses winking, and of course it was Patrick. Who else but my lost brother Patrick? By this time, Mom had seen me and cried, "Judd! There's Judd!" And Patrick turned, blinking to see me, and ran over at once, and grabbed me in a bear hug like no imaginable gesture of PJ's, still less pinches, saying, his voice choked with emotion, "Jesus, kid, you're all grown up!" Ringing the cowbell, there on the back veranda of the clabbered farmhouse on the New Canaan Road, her hair turned completely silver and glittering like mica, braided into a single thick plait swinging between her shoulder blades, there was Corinne Mulvaney, 62 years old, laughing like one of her own grandchildren, the color up in her cheeks, tugging the cord of the old gourd-shaped cowbell to summon us all to eat at last. It was nearing 6:30 p.m., but still bright as midday except in the shadows beneath the tall chestnut trees where picnic tables had been set, covered in bright American flag paper runners. 4th of July, but no fireworks, no explosive devices, Mom and Sable had insisted. Just red, white, and blue napkins, streamers. Tiny American flags fluttering from the veranda. Scram, in a delirium of joy at so many children, so much loving attention, wore an American flag kerchief around his neck. There were Whit and Marianne, playful as newlyweds, overseeing the grilling of hamburgers, hot dogs, and spicy Italian sausage at the pit barbecue. And there were Mom and Sable overseeing the preparation of chicken pieces brushed with Sable's Texas hot sauce at the portable grill. On the buffet picnic table were enormous bowls of homemade salads, a platter heaped with raw vegetables beautiful as works of art, bell peppers, tomatoes, sliced cucumbers, zucchini and yellow squash from Mom's garden. There were platters of fresh baked breads, muffins, biscuits, Ethel Hausman's pineapple glazed Virginia ham that must have weighed 20 pounds.
A small gang of us husked the ears of sweet corn I'd brought, and my perky sister-in-law, Vicky, and I boiled them in the kitchen, in immense pots of water on Mom's and Sable's old-fashioned gas stove. Vicky set the timer. 5 minutes exactly. Overcooking makes corn mushy. Vicky had a bossy, flirty manner I'd have adored if I had been the type to fall in love with an older brother's wife, saying as we waited for the timer to ring with an air of one imparting a secret, "Judd, I just can't get over your brother Patrick. He isn't at all what I'd expected." I asked, curious, what she'd expected, what Mike had led her to expect of Patrick, and she said, "Well, I guess I expected someone not so Mulvaney." I asked, "But what is Mulvaney?" For the concept was genuinely baffling to me. Vicky said, stroking her belly that was so pert and round beneath her buttercup yellow maternity smock, and fixing me with a look as if I must be joking to ask such a question, "Why, you, all of you." There were 27 of us, adults, children, babies in high chairs and on laps, beneath the tall chestnut trees behind Mom's and Sable's house. The sky overhead glowed with a warm sepia cast as if flames licked beyond the scrim of cloud. Barnswifts soared and darted overhead. They nested under the eaves of the outbuildings, Mom explained, dozens of them, and neither she nor Sable had the heart to run them off. Whit West rose to propose a toast to Corinne Mulvaney and Sable Mills, and all the Mulvaneys present, naming us in turn, insisting we rise blushing in our places, and all the Housemans present, 5, no, 6 Housemans. How had Mom talked such unsociable folks into coming here today? And the toast included, too, relatives of Sable Mills, of whom there were a half dozen, and people who'd come a long distance, who in fact had come the longest distance. Whit West peered out among us like an affable, just slightly bullying master of ceremonies, until Patrick laughingly volunteered, "Katya and me, I suppose." And we all applauded. No wonder I was a little drunk, such a humming, buzzing day. Cicadas shrieking out of the trees like an aberration of the inner ear, thinking, "How did we get to this? How do we deserve this?" In late October, it would be 5 years since Dad died. 5 years. For Mike's and Marianne's children, who'd never known their grandfather, a lifetime. Someone poked my shoulder. I turned, and there came Mom, Marianne, Vicky, and Sable bearing candlelit cakes, and everyone sang happy birthday loudly, and it took me a beat or two to catch on. What was this? Feebly, I protested my birthday wasn't until the 11th, but no one paid the slightest heed. What amazing cakes were presented to me. A 3-tiered chocolate fudge, a carrot pumpkin ginger yogurt pound cake, Whit West's special recipe. An angel food with stiff, sculpted egg white frosting, and a strawberry ice cream cake in a heart-shaped tin. Each cake glimmered with candles. 30? Which added up to a phantasmagoric 120. "God, am I this old?" I groaned. Much laughter, as if I'd meant to be funny. I stood swaying at my place at the table, cheeks burning with self-consciousness, dazed, disoriented. I'd suspected nothing, not a thing. Hadn't given any thought to my upcoming 30th birthday except a twinge of dread. Once you turn 30 in America, you really are not a kid any longer. No more excuses. Now came a flurry of kisses aimed at my face. Mulvaney's and others, my little nieces and nephews held up for special hugs. "Say happy birthday, Uncle Judd. Say I love you, Uncle Judd." And a succession of blinding Polaroid flash shots. "For posterity," Whit, whose camera it was, said, "and to prove that you Mulvaneys all exist in the same time frame." Witty Whit West. How well my brother-in-law knew us. I was equal to the task, but just barely. Blew out every candle of the 120. I was applauded, cheered. I was prevailed upon to speak, and I stood mute and blushing and stammered finally, "Thanks, I'll never forget this, I guess." And they applauded anyway as if I'd been brilliant. My head was buzzing like a hornet's hive, a roaring in my ears that was happiness on the brink of passing over into something else. Terror? Paralysis? Mom must have seen it in my face, that happiness that's almost too much to bear. She stood beside me, lifting her glass, voice rapturous. "I'm just so, so happy every one of you is here. It just seems so amazing and wonderful and, well,
a miracle, but I guess it's just ordinary life, how we all keep going, isn't it?
Suddenly stammering herself and sniffing, and everyone laughed and quickly applauded, and Sable leapt to her feet, raising her glass too, and cried,
"You tell him, sweetheart, you're the girl who knows."
It was so, as Vicky had said. Patrick had become a Mulvaney at last in his long exile from home. Unless it was California that had loosened and lightened him. Even sun-bleached his hair that grew long and shaggy to his shoulders, tanned him dark as a walnut from spending so much time outdoors, he said, backpacking in the mountains of Northern California, hiking along the Monterey coast. He and Katya had made the journey east on Patrick's 1988 Honda in a looping route up through northern Nevada and Utah and southern Wyoming, taking 15 days. He had a month's leave from the Berkeley Institute of Child Development, where he was assistant to the director. He developed a technique for treating autistic children and seemed to be, so far as I could gather, a licensed physical therapist as well.
"Our work is continuously experimental and evolving. There's no point in trying to define it."
Katya was a graduate student in mathematics at UC Berkeley, the Russian-born daughter of Jews who'd been allowed to emigrate out of the Soviet Union in the mid-60s, both of them scientists at Caltech. When Patrick introduced me to Katya, she smiled shyly at me from beneath her oversized Greek sailor's cap, lovely thick-lashed black eyes, and said,
"Oh, Judd, I've heard so much about you from Patrick."
I said, "You have? What?" Katya bit her lower lip, like a child who has blundered into inviting more attention than she'd wished. Patrick just laughed.
"Go on, Katya, tell him." "What?"
Amazing how the pinch crease had vanished from between Patrick's eyebrows, as if it had never been. My brother was more boyish at the age of 35 than he'd been at 15.
"Well,"
Katya smiled at me hesitantly and frowned, and touched one of her delicate earlobes where a tiny gold stud gleamed.
"He has said you are a good brother. He loves you very much."
I laughed, embarrassed. "Well, impossible to say, Patrick, hey, I love you. Patrick, I'm angry as hell at you. I'll never forgive you for abandoning us, but now you're back. Now I've seen you and touched you, I guess I love you again. So that's it." Patrick laughed and let his hand fall on my shoulder, brotherly affectionate, as if I'd spoken aloud. Now he'd come back to us, it was as if that old Patrick and those old sorrows had never been. Katya smiled shyly.
"Judd, your former house, High Point Farm? I hope to see it tomorrow. Patrick says we must go to look."
"Well, it's changed. It isn't the same now."
"Not the same?"
"The house has been painted white. The front yard has been landscaped. Some of the big old oaks are down." Patrick overheard and said,
"You've been back, Judd?"
"Not really," I was embarrassed, speaking with such bitterness. "I've driven by a few times, parked on the road, but not recently."
"What about Mom?"
We looked to the head of the table where Mom was lifting a sleep-dazed Molly Ellen in her arms. The baby's mouth gleamed smilingly with wet, and her bare feet paddled like a frog's. Mom's face was suffused with emotion, tenderness. Lanky, raw-boned Whistle had gone, and who had taken her place? A silvery-haired woman of 62 with a ravaged throat but a surprisingly smooth face for one who'd spent so much time outdoors with no care for outward appearances.
"No. She hasn't tried to make friends with the new owners?"
"Mom has better things to do." For a while then, Patrick brooded in silence. I guessed he might want to change the subject, as Mike shrank visibly from speaking of the farm. Why rake over that old hurt? And had never taken Vicky and his children anywhere near it. Nor had Marianne, of course. Oh, the Wests were always too busy. Whit was a dynamo of a man, living in present time. I thought I would change the subject, and asked Katya how she and Patrick had met. Katya colored pleasurably, for this was a good memory, and said, in her lightly accented English, what sounded like, "at the hunger strike." I cupped my hand to my ear, not certain I'd heard correctly. What? Katya laughed at the expression on my face and said,
Yes, a hunger strike in Oakland.
Patrick said, It was more than just a hunger strike. It was an active demonstration, too. The Berkeley Peace Coalition was demonstrating to protest Oakland police brutality against ethnic minorities, and some of us were arrested for blocking the street in front of police headquarters.
And that's how Katya and I met, in the back of a van. Patrick spoke so matter-of-factly, I responded in kind to show how I took such bizarre information in stride.
Well, was the strike effective?
And Patrick smiled at me, yet with his old pinch hauteur, a just perceptible curl of the upper lip, just so you know what the perimeters of his new tolerance were.
About as effective as you'd expect any feeble human action to be in this galaxy that's a river of blind matter rushing at 400 miles per second toward the Hydra Centauri supercluster of galaxies.
Katya winced and bit her lower lip, her gaze plummeting, as if in embarrassment of me that I should ask Patrick such a question.
Oh, Mommy!
It was little Willie, that excitable child. One of Mom's and Sable's cats, a sleek, sand-colored tom named Tiger, had darted brazenly along the table to seize in his jaws Willie's part-eaten hamburger, where it lay on a paper plate, and leapt with it to the ground before anyone could prevent him. Willie, who of all children you'd expect to be used to animals, tugged at his mother and cried,
"Oh, Mommy, the bad kitty!"
Marianne laughed and kissed his forehead and said, "Now, honey, you know better. No kitties are bad, and you weren't going to finish that anyway." So whatever we'd been discussing, almost heatedly, Patrick, Katya, and Judd, was deflected and dropped. It was around that time I drifted from the party, needing to escape for a few minutes. I wasn't drunk, but my head was ringing like the cowbell. Walking blindly in this place I knew to be my mom's new home, but which I didn't exactly recognize, like one of those dreams in which a familiar landscape is subtly yet irrevocably altered. Thinking, if this is another time, then who am I? I'd gotten to be proud of myself for the personality I'd built, piece by piece, like shingling a roof. Precisely, overlapping, imbricating to prevent water damage. Not that I'd allow Mom to boast about me in my presence. So young, already editor of a newspaper. Nor did I give much thought to my professional accomplishments, such as they were. But I'd built a damned sturdy personality for myself, damned if I was going to dismantle it. Beyond the antique barn that was lit from within for the evening's festivities, a floating, glowing arc. Beyond the goat pasture where the animals dozed on their feet. Beyond the clearing where there was a narrow brook, a tributary of Alder Creek. I stood for a while inhaling deep, calming breaths, filling my lungs with the sobriety of night. I heard footsteps behind me, a voice. "Judd?" It was Patrick. He caught up with me. We stood for a while together in silence, staring at the brook. I felt a childish stab of satisfaction he'd left Katya behind, just for now. Finally, I said, my voice oddly weak, pleading, "I'm just not used to it anymore, I guess. So many people." Patrick made a sound, meaning he understood. I said, "It's like happiness is a balloon, and the balloon is somehow my head, and it's being blown up bigger and bigger, and I'm scared as hell it's gonna burst, and I'll be left with nothing but scraps of rubber." Patrick said, thoughtfully, "Yeah, right. I feel exactly the same way. Being angry, resentful, that's easier somehow. To a degree." I realized I was fearful of Patrick asking me questions that must be asked, yet not now. I would talk to him tomorrow, the next day, all the days to come. I would never let him go again, and I would tell him everything in my heart. I would tell him how Marianne had never known, had never guessed, what had been done for her sake, for the family's sake. I would tell him that so far as I knew, Zachary Lunt had kept the secret too, if in fact he'd recognized Patrick in his disguise. I would tell him that neither Mom nor I knew anything of the Lunts now. We'd put all that behind us. I would tell him that Dad had insisted upon cremation. That had been his last coherent request, overriding Mom's pleas, his hoarse, adamant words, "Cremate my body and scatter my ashes, and that's the kindest thing you can do for me. Amen." How at the end, before lapsing into his final delirium, he'd been assured and even dignified in that old bulldog way of Michael Mulvaney Sr. wanting to get a job finished, over and done. That was why there was no cemetery plot anywhere, no gravestone, no memorial. All this I would tell my brother, in time. Patrick said, as if he'd been hearing my thoughts, "After I left that day, Easter Sunday, remember? It all just drained out of me, like poison draining out of my blood, like I'd been sick, infected, and hadn't known it until the poison was gone. I don't regret any of it, though. I think revenge must be good. The Greeks knew how blood calls out for blood. I think it must be inborn in our genes, the instinct for justice, the need to restore balance. I could have torn his throat out with my teeth, almost. But, well... He shrugged. His voice trailed off. I saw a shimmering movement of white in the woods, a patch of movement, and wondered if the doe had returned or would return. But we were alone. Patrick laughed. Bet you didn't think I'd make it for the family reunion, right? I protested. Oh, no, Patrick. I had a premonition, actually, you would. On the way back, Patrick took me to his and Katya's campsite, in a grove of trees above a turn in the New Canaan Road, about 50 yards from Mom's and Sable's house. His motorcycle was parked on the hillside just below. He'd taken out of his pocket what appeared to be a Swiss Army knife and switched on the pencil-thin flashlight attached to illuminate the Honda, which was a two-seater, a 1988 model and fairly battered. "Ever ridden one of these?" he asked. And when I said no, he said, "Tomorrow, then. You are staying over tonight, aren't you?" I said I wasn't sure, and he said, "Oh, come on. Mom's counting on it. All her kids under one roof?" I pointed out that he wouldn't be under the same roof with the rest of us, and he said, in his old contrary way, "At breakfast I will. Count on it." With big brotherly zeal, then, as if all adult complexities of emotion might as well be shrugged off, for the moment at least, Patrick lifted the mosquito net flap of the tent and led me inside. Both of us had to bend and then to squat. The tent was no more than 5 feet at its pitch. Patrick spoke proudly of the tent, which was made of a breathable nylon with a collapsible fiberglass pole. There was a damp, grassy fragrance here mixed with something delicate and sweet. I wanted to think was Katya's cologne or even her hair. I saw Katya's hair unbraided, unwound, and brushed shining around her face. Patrick was saying, again as if in response to my unuttered thoughts, that he'd introduce Katya to camping out, backpacking, shortly after they met. He loved her very much, he said. She was the first woman he'd ever been able to love, and that only at the age of 32, and he'd been frightened it would never happen, but somehow it had. It does, in time. There was a moment of silence between us. I understood that I wasn't expected to say anything, not a word. As if we'd been like this, at such ease with each other for all of the 14 years we'd lost. Patrick showed me by flashlight a first aid kit small enough to fit in a jacket pocket. Waterproof candles, a waterproof lantern, everything so wonderfully small, compact. He and Katya shared a single sleeping bag, nylon, with flannel lining you could unzip and remove, as of course they had for summer. "And look," Patrick said, pleasure in his voice, "at this pocket-sized weather radio that provided up-to-the-minute bulletins 24 hours a day from the National Weather Service." As if a demonstration were necessary, Patrick switched on the radio, and at once a man's voice intoned through pulses of static, "Prevailing winds out of the north-northeast from Saskatchewan, 20 to 25 miles an hour. At the airport in Billings, Montana, temperature 64 degrees Fahrenheit and barometer steady at..." And there was Patrick, smiling happily, squatting in his nylon tent, showing his kid brother a pocket-sized weather radio that was in fact a miracle of technology. What relief in having access to detailed weather facts 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You have only to switch on a tiny button to hear so solemn and incantatory a recitation of simple, unassailable facts beyond all human subjectivity, will, yearning. I laughed, poking Patrick in the arm. Had to laugh at that expression in his face he'd had when we were boys, when we were the Mulvaneys. This has been a Highbridge audio presentation.